You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, March 19th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Evan Bernstein.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, Richard Saunders. Richard, welcome back, man.
Well, hello.
Hello.
Oh, you weirdo.
An oldie but a goodie.
Hello, so, guys. Hello from Sydney, Australia. Great to be with you.
Before we get into everything, Richard, I do want to say that, you probably noticed that Jay is not joining us this week. And I hate to start the show on a down note, but I do have to explain Jay's absence. He's fine, but unfortunately, one of our close friends, Michael Orticelli, died earlier this week. He was tragically killed in a motorcycle accident. Jay and he were very close friends, so Jay's probably going to be heading out to Arizona where his family is, and certainly not able to do the show this week. Michael Orticelli was definitely a friend of the SGU. He is the artist who did the SGU fish for us, for example, and a really, really great guy. We're all very upset about, you know, about losing him, and I told Jay that we would dedicate this episode to Michael.
Yeah, that's nice, yeah.
Absolutely. Michael was, he was one of those rare guys, and I'm just not saying this. I mean, listening to all the comments on his Facebook page, this guy was one of those rare gems of a person. He was just so incredibly nice and sweet and amazingly talented at whatever he did, and a big fan of the show. I don't think he missed too many shows ever. And he contributed some really good artwork for us. I mean, the guy is just, he was an amazing guy, and he is going to be missed.
I didn't know him as well as Jay or perhaps the other guys here did. However, when I did meet him, and we obviously, you know, got along quite well quite early on, and then he would come back to me and just throw me a note or a little message on Facebook every once in a while and, like, ask my opinion for something. He just really, really down-to-earth guy who really wanted to learn a lot about a lot of different things. You know, obviously he was into art and sports and other things, but, you know, he would come to me and sort of, you know, give me a certain level of respect that I don't think, you know, I would have expected out of someone who was otherwise really just a complete stranger. And he's going to be missed.
We'll probably talk more about it next week when Jay's back on the show, but I did want to mention why Jay wasn't here. And definitely, you know, express our sadness over the loss of one of our friends.
Yeah.
But let's go on with the show. Richard, tell us quickly what's going on with the skeptics in Australia, down under.
Well, I don't know how we can do it. I don't know if it's even possible to even think about it, but we're going to try and have a bigger and brighter and better convention this year than last year.
Now, good luck.
Yeah, good luck with that, right? Because SGU were the star turn, the star act of our convention last year here in Sydney, which was fabulous. What a great convention it was. And we all had a hell of a time doing that bus tour down to Canberra and back.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
that was a lot of fun. I got to be your bus driver, and that's something that I won't forget in a hurry. That was
you and your brother.
Doing? Jeff. Yeah, he's well. He loves the SGU shirt that you gave him, you know, the robot one.
Yeah.
So that was a big time, and one day when we get very old and we can really tell people what really happened on that trip. But that can wait.
Oh boy.
Oh boy. when the books come out. But what we're going to do this year is in October the 16th to the 18th will be our next national convention. And that's going to be in the city of Brisbane, the capital of the state of Queensland, right up in the tropical bit of Australia. And we're really looking forward to that. It's going to be, well, Australian skeptics know how to put on a convention, but we've got Brian Schmidt, the Nobel Prize winner. He's going to be speaking.
Oh yeah.
Susan Gerbeck from Guerrilla Skepticism will be there. Joe Nickel will be there.
Joe.
Yeah, lots of other special Australian guests and skeptical people. I'm sure the Skeptic Zone podcast will be running about doing interviews as we normally do. So that's the big news coming out of Australia, is we're working up to our next big national convention. Well, that's the fun big news out of Australia.
Well, I got to say that I'm kind of glad that we can't make it this year, because as much as I love Australia and Sydney, I would not want to be there in October for a good chunk of October, because I'm sorry, but you guys just haven't learned how to do Halloween properly yet.
Oh, yeah.
But I have.
We're trying.
I've got hopes. I've got high hopes.
And it's really weird because I think it's fine. Why not? It's the kids love it and you know, spooks and candy
some
and
adults,
all the rest of it. But there's this backlash against what people perceive as the Americanization of Australia. Which I think is a bit crazy because a lot of our culture is simply American anyway. Rock and roll to television sitcoms to all the rest of it. So.
Oh, come
on.
Yeah.
Next you're going to be telling me you guys don't eat peanut butter.
Peanut what?
Come on.
Exactly. Exactly. Coca-Cola lifestyle, you know?
If I go there in October, I want to go to haunted houses. I want to go to a haunted Halloween event.
You want to go to a haunted house? Good luck with that.
Cry.
I have been in my travels in Australia. I have been invited to several haunted locations. You know, this is Australia's most haunted sewer system, or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah, that's right. And it's
most haunted eucalyptus tree.
It is. With the ghost.
In fact, one could make the argument that anywhere you go is the most haunted
one
place.
One could.
Zero
ghostly koalas. They're frightening. But as you know, that when you go along to these things, nothing happens. And it's a bit of an anticlimax.
Bob's talking about a theatrically haunted house.
Oh, a theatrically haunted.
Yes.
Then that's different. Yes.
Actors, blood, special
acting.
Effects, zombies, screaming, people peeing in their pants, the whole nine yards.
Is that what Richard was talking about?
All right. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about skepticism in Australia, but first we're going to do our next installment of Forgotten Superheroes of Science.
This week I'll be talking about Irene Joliot-Curie, 1897 to 1956.
Don't you mean Marie Curie?
No.
This
is the almost as famous and I think probably much less well-known daughter of Marie and Pierre Curie.
Daughter?
She was a chemist who, along with her husband, discovered artificial or induced radioactivity. Ever hear of her? Steve, now you were kind of on the fence about whether she should have been included. I think she's
Well, we've talked about her on the show before.
Yeah, we have mentioned her. But I think she's very, very unknown,
she's
at all.
Overshadowed by her
completely.
Her mother, who was apparently the only female scientist most of the population can name.
Yeah, right.
That's true.
Gosh. Now, Marie and Pierre, of course, they were the Nobel Prize winning scientists for their groundbreaking work isolating natural radiation. Irene clearly inherited not only a good environment, but also some smarts as well. Apparently she was very good at math and science in general. But her educational start was very interesting. Her mother and other prominent French academics formed what they call the cooperative, in which they would all teach each other's kids at their homes. So the various kids would go to the different people's houses and they'd be taught by these famous at the time and people and many names we would recognize today being taught by them. So that was really cool, I thought. But later in life, she met and married Frederick Joliot and they became a family of super scientists.
Ooh.
Actually, this was interesting.
Do they have capes?
Yeah.
not in public.
No capes.
This couple actually had early brushes with history. They almost discovered the neutron and almost discovered the positron, came very close, but they failed to go that very last step to understand exactly what they were dealing with. And so the credit went to others who fully recognized, oh, this is what this is type of thing. So they came so close, but it seemed reading about these guys, this couple seemed fame was inevitable. Something would have happened, regardless, because, they discovered that you can artificially create radiating materials. Now, they did this by bombarding a stable isotope of elements such as aluminum with alpha particles, which are essentially helium nuclei. This produced a radioactive isotope of phosphorus. So it was an incredible breakthrough. And what, if you think about it, what they essentially did was to perform a form of alchemy, right? They're essentially turning one element into another, which is kind of funny. Of course, it's not gold or anything, but it was an amazing breakthrough. And for this, they won a Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1935 for the discovery of artificial or synthetic radioactivity. This work helped lay the foundation for nuclear medicine today. And it was also the foundation used by another group of scientists to discover nuclear fission itself, were splitting atoms to release huge amounts of energy. They played an integral part in that discovery by their discovery of artificial radiation. So mention Irene Joliot-Curie to your friends, perhaps when discussing the role of neutron activation in the creation of radionuclides.
Right.
And, you know, ironically, like her mother, she died of leukemia at the age of 58 because of exposure to radioactive materials. The one source I'm reading said she accidentally was exposed to polonium when a sealed capsule exploded in her lab.
Ooh,
right.
And that might have been
the key.
The key, yeah.
What really did it, that's true.
All right, let's go on to some news items. We'll start with you, Richard. You're going to tell us about the Australian government's recent comments on homeopathy.
Wow, this is it's hard to impart to you how important this one is. Let me just go back a few years, however. In 2012, Australian skeptics and other people were very concerned about the antics of a group called Homeopathy Plus, an online homeopathy dispensary, I guess you'd say, who sell homeopathic preparations for this, that, and whatever. And they were also making comments along the lines of the population in Australia should not trust the whooping cough vaccination, because naturally they're anti-vaccination, these homeopaths. And so they were casting great doubt on the efficacy of the whooping cough vaccination whilst promoting homeopathic alternatives to vaccination. So one of the things that resulted from that in 2012, we awarded them Homeopathy Plus and their proprietor Fran Sheffield our Bent Spoon Award, which is our annual Raspberry Award for these sort of people. And that was great. That year, James Randi was in town, so he actually presented that, which was pretty cool. But it didn't stop there. The Australian government, one of the bodies of the Australian government, the ACCC, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, actually took this mob to court for these statements, because they considered these statements to be false. And after a long court battle, I guess you would say, proceedings, finally in December, late December, just last year, the court handed down a finding which was completely against Homeopathy Plus and vindicated the Australian Competitions and Consumer Commission, which was a huge victory. And we're still waiting to hear what penalties this homeopath will have to pay. They might have to pay the government's legal costs and other fines and things like that. But the statement is huge. It sends a big statement out there that if you're in Australia and you're going to put on your website things saying that the whooping cough vaccination doesn't work but you should try homeopathy, you're going to get taken to court by the government. That's fantastic. But now, in the last week, National Health and Medical Research Council, which is a government body under the watchful eye of the Minister for Health and the Department of Health, has released a statement on homeopathy, basically saying that they did a very careful, in-depth study of many, 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 many research papers into homeopathy. In fact, they had 1,800 papers to sift through, 1,800. But only 225 of those met proper standards that they could actually regard as a proper test, so they could then check the validity of those tests. They came to the conclusion, which was just no surprise to skeptics, of course, that there is no good evidence to support the claim that homeopathy is better than a placebo for treating any condition. And this is just as about as strong a statement as you can get. Now, I think, Steve, you're going to post the links that I sent you to those statements from the government. And I encourage everybody to read it. The press release itself is quite short and concise. And I actually read it out last week the week before on the Skeptic Zone podcast. It's really worth hearing or reading for yourself. But on the website of the government body, the National Health and Medical Research Council, there's an extensive Q&A and methodology, so you can really see what's going on there. But this is a huge statement. Now, this sends a powerful message out there to people like pharmacies who are still selling homeopathy. And we can say, look, it's clear the government did an extensive research into all the studies of homeopathy, the valid ones, because they're all like, we're just hokey. And the conclusions are clear. Now we can say, with the support of the government, why are you selling sugar pills to your patients? Now, as you can imagine, the alternative medicine crowd weren't exactly delighted with this,
no,
these findings. And there's a couple of...
It's going to cut into their pockets a bit. Well, make their wallets a little lighter, perhaps.
Yes, Evan, I can understand why you can say that, but I always think there's a lot of people out there in the alt med business, and homeopathy is a great example of that, who are sincere, who really believe it works. So to this is an incredibly unjustified attack on what they do. And this is reflected in the official press releases by, in one instance, the Complementary Medicines Australia, that outfit, which is a very interesting press release, and I'll ask Steve to also link to that, where they basically say that the study had shoddy methodology, selective research, lacked experience, the evidence they used was flawed, anything to other than to say that of course homeopathy doesn't work. And the other one, which is really worth reading, although it's 13 pages long, is the official statement or reply from the Australian Homeopathic Association. It's a classic example of quoting testimonials, ad hominem attacks, crying foul, a mixture of conspiracy theories in there. It's really worth reading.
This is similar to when the UK government, Commons Science and Technology Committee, did a thorough multi-year review of homeopathy and concluded it doesn't work, it can't work, it's witchcraft, and we should stop supporting it.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, of course, the homeopaths, as you say, their responses are, this is unfair, it was a terrible review. They just lie about it, to be honest with you. I listened to multiple interviews with homeopaths saying, oh, we have thousands of studies which show that homeopathy works. No, you don't. You know, the studies show it doesn't work. And as you said, just trying to attack this review. They often refer to the Swiss review, but it's always, listen to exactly what they're saying. The Swiss review didn't say there's evidence that homeopathy works. What they said was, you know, that they recommended supporting homeopathy within the Swiss health system, which is slightly different. You know, that's a different conclusion. And I've spoken about that before. This was basically a rigged committee packed with homeopaths. They couldn't, but even then they couldn't say that the clinical evidence supports efficacy for any homeopathic remedy. So they had to say, we have to look at other kinds of evidence, like anecdotal evidence, you know. They basically had to try to spin it to make it seem positive when in fact the evidence is negative.
Well, this is a very good point you make, Steve, because to a lot of these people, testimonials equal evidence.
Listen to this. There was an Irish journalist, I want to give this guy a shout out, Jonathan McCree, who is clearly, he's not a scientist, he's a journalist, but he clearly totally gets it. And he did a program on homeopathy where he completely trashed it. And then somebody wrote in a letter to him, which was a homeopath saying, you think we're all stupid, deluded, or charlatans, and that we're using treatments that we know don't work. Well, we've seen it work. We're homeopaths because our anecdotal evidence basically shows us that it works.
Yep, yep.
Completely missing the point. And McCree's response was perfect. I mean, he just completely demolished her.
He totally gets it.
He referred to the Australian review. He referred to the UK review. He quoted extensively from Science-Based Medicine, which is why I thought it was well-written. And then he says at the end, this is dangerous. This is dangerous nonsense. You know, I have a duty to inform the public that taking a homeopathic vaccine will not protect you against these diseases. And the scientific community is in agreement. There is no controversy here. So he completely got it as a journalist, and I love seeing that. Mm. He definitely deserves recognition for doing that. But it also shows you the strategies of the homeopaths. It's all ignore the man behind the curtain type of diversions and appeals to, as you say, appeal to anecdote.
But also remember, to a lot of these people who the sincerely, truly believers in homeopathy, the only avenue left open to them is to assume that the findings of this council are flawed, or they're corrupt, or
because they know it works.
Because they know it works.
That's their premise. That's their premise, and therefore anything which says otherwise, it's got to be
conspiracy
or flawed or whatever.
That's okay. That's fine. Take it out of the realm of science. Put it squarely in faith.
Yeah, and start the cult of homeopathy.
That's right.
That's what functionally that is. What you are.
So. I mean, with a lot of these people, I've done this. I try to start a conversation, and you can't get past the word energy, because they're using the word energy to mean anything they want it to mean.
It means whatever they want it to mean.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Great standards.
Yeah, Humpty Dumpty said that in Through the Looking Glass. Here's the quote. "When I use a word," Humpty Dumpty said in a rather scornful tone, "it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less." All right, Evan, you're going to tell us about a very disappointing New York Times article about the new Apple Watch.
Yeah, it's from the New York Times style section. Remember that Gallagher skit where he talks about style?
Yeah.
Here's the title of the piece. "The Health Concerns in Wearable Tech" by Nick Bilton.
Why is a health article in the style section by a non-science journalist? Anyway, this is not going to go well.
It doesn't fit anywhere else. Yeah. Here's what he writes. "In 1946, a new advertising campaign appeared in magazines with a picture of a doctor in a lab coat holding a cigarette and the slogan, 'More doctors smoke Camel than any other cigarette.' No, this wasn't a spoof. Back then, doctors were not aware that smoking could cause cancer, heart disease, and lung disease. In a similar vein, some researchers and consumers are now asking whether wearable computers will be considered harmful in several decades' time."
Oh, boy.
Okay, here we go. Now, that's quite a comparison. Smoking cigarettes to wearing electronics which emit radiation. Cigarettes, if you need to be reminded, cigarettes are proven carcinogens. The chemicals in the smoke, they're inhaled directly into the mouth, throat, and lungs. Some of these chemicals in the cigarette smoke are physically addictive.
Yeah.
Which means that, you know, you're most likely to be a casual smoker. You're probably a consistent smoker. The negative health effects of cigarette consumption is extremely well documented. Risks of cancer skyrocket with nicotine use, and life expectancy decreases, and it's measured in years and many years.
Yeah, just also, it's historically incorrect. I mean, the story is much more complicated. In 1946, scientists absolutely knew that there were health concerns about cigarette smoking. This is sort of the tail end of like some doctors selling out. By the 1950s, it was absolutely proven. I mean, then the evidence was overwhelming. Everyone except the tobacco industry knew that smoking caused lung cancer, for example. And the evidence was getting there in the 1940s, and it was sort of starting in the 1930s. So it's just inaccurate. It's like at that point, we had no idea how dangerous cigarette smoking was. That's just not true.
He's comparing it to cell phone usage, basically.
Yeah.
Which, okay, so about that real quick. Cell phones do emit non-ionizing electromagnetic radiation, which is low-power, low-frequency form of radiation, which can be absorbed by tissues closest to where, say, the phone is held. Now, this is according to cancer.gov. I'm going to read right from their website, page 1. "Many studies have examined the potential health effects of non-ionizing radiation from radar, microwave ovens, and other sources. There is currently no consistent evidence that non-ionizing radiation increases cancer risk."
Yeah, because it's non-ionizing.
Right.
I know some people think that makes it impossible to cause cancer. I'm not willing to go there. You know,
no.
My colleagues and I say, yeah, it makes it unlikely, but not impossible, because, you know, there could be other mechanisms other than breaking chemical bonds that might increase carcinogenesis. Sure, that's not impossible. We don't know how it would do that, but it's definitely worth gathering evidence to make sure that there isn't any signal there. But go on, because, you know, the resources that this guy quotes is very telling.
Yeah, extremely telling. I'll jump down to the middle of the article where he refers to a longitudinal study conducted by a group of European researchers led by Dr. Lennart Hardell, a professor of oncology and cancer epidemiology at Örebro University Hospital in Sweden, concluded that taking on mobile or cordless phones for extended periods could triple the risk of a certain kind of brain cancer. Now, that sounds pretty scary, right? Triple the risk of cancer? Oh, my gosh. But wait. Wait, what kind of cancer exactly are we talking about? And what are the numbers here? All right. Even if the odds of developing, and we're talking about a glioma here. Even if the odds of developing a glioma were doubled or tripled, the risk would remain really, really low. So here are the numbers. A little more than 5 out of 100,000 Europeans, that's 0.005%, were diagnosed with any kind of malignant brain tumor between 1995 and 2002. And this is according to a 2012 study in the European Journal of Cancer. So if you're going to apply a triple rate there, the odds rise to about 16 out of 100,000.
But it's even worse, Evan. Let me tell you why. Hardell is the only researcher saying this.
Yes. The only one.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't know if you were going there, but every other researcher finds no correlation. He chose the one outlier, the only studies showing that there's any kind of correlation between cell phone use and brain cancers coming out of this one lab. And that's always a red flag. There's no independent replication. Everyone else is finding no correlation. So that's what I meant. He sort of cherry picked the one guy who has the outlying view and is presenting that as if that's the science. That's just horrible journalism.
It gets even better because who does he go to? I know. More follow up on this. Dr. Joseph Mercola.
That is embarrassing.
You're going to go to Joseph Mercola to booster your opinion on this matter.
Oh, boy.
Okay. Joseph Mercola, in case you don't know, he is, well, how would you classify
him? He's a quack.
I would call him, okay, thank you. I was going to use the term quack, but, you know.
In my opinion, he's a complete quack.
Look, search for him in the science-based medicine archives, and you can learn a lot about him. But, you know, and according to Joseph Mercola, it's all in the 3G and I suppose 4G technology. Well, here's what he said in an interview. The radiation really comes from the 3G connection on a cell phone, so devices like Jawbone Up and Apple Watch should be okay, but if you're buying a watch with a cellular chip in it, then you've got a cell phone attached to your wrist. That's a bad idea. Now, where did Mercola get this information about 3G? I really have no idea. I mean, in his articles on his website, he does also, guess where he goes back to, Steve? Dr. Leonard Hardell.
Yeah.
He goes back to that one source you were talking about.
Yeah, this was Nick Bilton was the journalist. So we give cred to McCree for doing a good job. Nick Bilton, horrible job. Total journalism fail, in my opinion. He shouldn't be writing about health issues, clearly. at all. Seriously. He doesn't know what he's doing, apparently. And this is an embarrassment to the New York Times.
Agreed. Know. Yes. Even the style section.
Even doesn't matter that's in the style section.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it matters a little bit, but still, just they shouldn't. Goes online. People don't look what section it's in. It's just an article online from the New York Times.
True.
Yeah. Orac wrote a good article, totally tearing it down. If you want to read that, you know, he pretty much goes through the whole thing. One thing that's always reassuring to me is that there hasn't been an increase in the incidence of brain cancer in the last 20 years. If there really was any correlation between cell phone use and brain cancer, we would be seeing huge spikes. We would be, I mean, it would be clear. I mean, where are all of these brain tumor patients that Hardell thinks exists? That, you know, they're not out there. We're not seeing the increase.
Everybody has a cell phone now.
Even if you think there would be a 5 or 10 year delay. Well, it's been 20 years, you know. We would be starting to see at the very least some uptick, and we're not. So that's very
reassuring.
You're
going to compare that to smoking cigarettes? I mean,
it's ridiculous.
My gosh.
It's ridiculous. Since we're talking about the Apple Watch, we got some email in response to Jay's offhand comment last week. You guys remember this where he said,
yes,
the Adams. Gold.
The gold, with the gold molecules being closer together.
I remember him saying, I love gold.
Yeah. There's an article in the Financial Times quoting someone from the company saying that the molecules, the gold molecules were closer together. And of course that's nonsense. You know,
molecules are atoms.
Well, he said molecules, but either way, it's a metal. It just doesn't work. You can't get those, you know, the atoms of a metal closer together. Anyway, but he was just not expressing properly what is actually going on, which is actually somewhat interesting. So, Apple came up with a method to make a composite, what they call a gold metal matrix composite. And it's not an alloy of gold. They're mixing gold with a ceramic. And that makes it lighter, harder, and scratch resistant.
Cool.
But interestingly, they're calling it 18 karat gold. Some people have criticized that, saying that you can't really use the karat system to describe this because that describes an alloy. So the way that the karat works, so it all depends on the ratio of gold atoms to alloy atoms. So if it's like 75% gold and 25% silver, that's 18 karat. But what they did, they're calling it 18 karat because it's the same percentage. It's 75% gold atoms and 25% ceramic, you know, particles. But the ceramic particles are much larger. So if anything, the gold atoms are farther apart. So that's why it's misleading. The 18 karat is misleading because there's obviously less gold per volume. Again, the ratio of atoms is the same, but there's less gold per volume. So it allows them to use less gold. You still get a nice gold. It's probably a really awesome technology for jewelry because you get this hard, scratch-resistant, very pretty gold metal. Yeah. Using less gold, so it should be cheaper. I mean, it's actually probably really, really nice. It was just that his comment was just not scientifically accurate. You know, that the atoms are closer together or the molecules are closer together. It's unfortunate that it's obscuring what sounds like a pretty cool technology.
It does. It does sound fairly cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the ceramics and all.
All right, Bob, you're going to tell us about the computer grid they're using for the LHC.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited, just in general about the, this is going to be in, you know,
just about life.
Okay. So after 3 years, the Large Hadron Collider will soon begin its next run. This is run number two.
Nice.
They refer to it. And as fascinating as its current and future potential discoveries are, though, I wanted to discuss a little bit, a component of the LHC that most people really don't give a second thought to, and that is the network of computers. The carburetor. The network of carburetors. I mean, the network of computers that handle the mountains of data that the LHC produces. So, now, as much as I love the LHC, I really only had a passing familiarity with how the proton collision data was managed. But now what I've learned is fascinating. So now you may have assumed that they have like one super hyper computer that really does a lot of the lifting. I mean, that would be not a completely ridiculous assumption. Supercomputers can do amazing things. Or maybe you were thinking that it was a bunch of these big computers networked together. But in actuality, they use the world's largest distributed computer grid to pull this off. Ooh. And this is called the Worldwide LHC Computing Grid, the WLCG. And it is pretty amazing. Now, CERN, even as far back as the 90s, before the LHC was even completely done at all, they knew that the computers that they had at the CERN facility would not be able to handle the flood of data that they were pretty much on the verge of producing. So you might be thinking, you know, where does this data come from and how much are we really talking about? Well, imagine the LHC. You've got a 27-kilometer underground tunnel with photons traveling at 99.9999991% the speed of light, going really fast, going around that ring 11,000 times a second. And wrapped around the tunnel, you've got the four primary experimental detectors. The ATLAS and the CMS are two that you have probably heard of. There's two others. And these record the collisions within their purview. And we're talking 600 million collisions per second, which is a lot of collisions. And each of these collisions have to be vetted. They've got to separate the wheat from the chaff. And the vast majority of this is just ho-hum, like, oh, well, we know what this is. We don't care very much about these collisions. But this tiny, tiny subset, yes, those are the ones that could lead to scientific revolutions. So what they have to do is they've got to go through them. On 1 in 10,000, they're stored in memory for a deeper look. And then once those are vetted, only 1 in 100 actually merit serious attention by scientists. So that means ultimately that 1 in a million collisions are of any interest at all. So they've got to go through all of those. So the next thing they have to do is they've got to distribute this data. They've got to deal with this data. Even though it's a tiny subset, it does build up really fast. So the WLCG, this computer grid, is a networked collaboration of global computer centers consisting of 174 facilities in 40 countries, all networked together. And they're set up in a tiered configuration. Now, if you look at all the tiers at once, you're talking about a total power of 250,000 processor cores with over 400 petabytes of tape and disk storage. Lots of room.
That's so many tiers I could cry.
Well, it's not that many tiers, actually, but there's a lot of processor cores. In the 4 years of operation, they've collected 60 million gigabytes of data at 60 petabytes. So that's just a mind-boggling amount of data.
Still a tiny fraction of a yottabyte.
Yeah, right. So you love that yottabyte, don't you?
I can't wait for the yottabyte. Yeah.
You're a yottophile?
Yes, I am. I'm obsessed with it. Before I die, there has to be a yottabyte.
Bob's more of a pedophile.
Oh my god.
I thought he was a pedophile.
That's like the third time I've told that joke. Relax.
Yeah. It just keeps getting funnier.
Well, apparently Evan doesn't even remember.
No, it's just shocking every time we hear it. That's all.
Right. So now tier zero is CERN. They are tier zero. They've got 73,000 processor cores. They take the raw data and they feed it into their data center and they aggregate the data and then they copy it to long-term tape storage. And then they take that, they take a piece of that and they distribute it to tier one. Now, tier one is about 15 around there. That number has been, you know, fluctuates. I've heard different numbers, but I've heard 12, 13, 15, 15 computer centers. They're located all over the U.S., the U.K., Italy, Spain, a whole bunch of different countries. Their purpose is to act as a critical backup of the data. You can't, you know, you can't just leave this in one facility. If there's a fire or a meteor, if you lose all that, you're not getting it back. So they're critical for backup. They also do data reprocessing and analysis. So they fulfill those key roles. And each tier one then is in turn connected to one or more of the 160 tier two sites. Now tier two, they were originally slated to do data analysis and simulations, but they've also, begun to handle, at least for run one, they, also handled some data reprocessing, which they weren't really scheduled to do. And they also handle the unanticipated peak loads. So when they're doing lots of, they're doing lots of work over at CERN. Tier two can take up the slack when the peaks are really high. So, and then finally, there's, most websites don't even mention tier three, but there is a tier three. It's not as,
supposedly,
not as formal as the other ones, but, the tier three nodes can consist of small computer clusters in universities all the way down to a single PC. All of which are authorized for use by the grid regularly. Now, when I say regularly, I'm talking 10,000 scientists throughout the entire world that are allowed to use this grid night or day, 24/7, 365.24 days a year. They get on that and they usually can without hardly any problem. That thing is up all the time. Now, everything I've described, guys, that pretty much applies to what was called Run 1 of the LHC, which ended in 2012 with the discovery of the Higgs. And so they, you know, it hasn't been running really since that time. But they've got to prepare for it because a lot of stuff is going to happen this year. They install powerful new electromagnets that will accelerate the twin proton beams to 13 trillion electron volts. That's 5 trillion electron volts more than they had before. So that means that the collision energy is going to roughly double. So that means that it's going to produce about three times the number of collisions that were being done per second.
That was 600 million a second.
During run one. Right. So you're talking, it's going to explode and they needed to handle that. So to handle this vast increase in data production, they had a bunch of projects that they've been working on. They have not been idle. What they did was they increased the CPU and data storage by 30%. That's a big increase. They implemented multi-core processing. The processors can have 2, 4, 8 CPUs in one package. So they had to rewrite a lot of their code to handle this, these multi-threaded instructions. And, the other major project that they work on was they created a new network protocol called XRootD to handle the transfers of these huge data sets over the network efficiently. So after all that work, the LHC now appears to be ready to handle all those extra demands that are going to be placed on it this year. They could conceivably make amazing discoveries about supersymmetry, magnetic monopoles, even new dimensions of existence. I hope even one of those comes to fruition, if not all of them. It would be amazing. But no matter what they accomplish, remember that the biggest computing grid on the planet made it all possible, among other things.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Wow. Imagine having to do a firmware update on that thing.
Oh, man.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Richard, I have a question for you.
Yeah,
do you have naturopaths in Australia?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what they are? You probably do. Do you think the average Australian knows what a naturopath is?
Ah, good question. I would suspect that the average Australian would simply think a naturopath is another sort of doctor.
Yeah.
Somebody with solid training behind them who knows how to take care of your health. They, to be honest, you know, people like you and me and our listeners, you know, they know a lot more than, on the subject, and that's fine. But yeah, your average person in the street would just, it's like a chiropractor. Your average person in the street would simply assume a chiropractor is just like a specialist.
Yeah, I get that a lot too. A lot of people think they're MDs, you know, when they're not. Yeah, I think a lot of people think that naturopaths are like nutritionists and herbalists, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Makes sense.
But scientifically trained in some capacity.
Well, they sell themselves.
Trained.
I'm saying that's the perception. People perceive them as being just as well trained as perhaps any other specialist.
Yeah, but they present themselves that way. So I want to talk about naturopathic medicine. We don't actually talk about that a lot on the show. I know I've mentioned it before, because we have a new blogger for us at Science Based Medicine, Britt Marie Hermes, who was trained as a naturopath, but at some point, shortly after she got her ND degree, the scales fell from her eyes and she realized that it was all bullshit. So now she's no longer practicing as a naturopath and she's writing for us a series of essentially exposés. The first one is up there, ND Confession Part 1.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool.
So yeah, it's very good. So she's very disillusioned, and I've had emails and comments from other naturopaths or former naturopaths who, again, went into it thinking that they were going to get trained in nutrition and natural medicine and then realized that they were being taught complete nonsense and pseudoscience, felt cheated. Yeah. They felt like they were sold a bill of goods. But of course, that's the minority. I think most people who go through that training practice as naturopaths and believe the philosophy. So they, market themselves as a distinct form of primary care. That is how they are trying to market themselves. They refer to themselves in that way. I actually had a naturopath tell me, they were actually talking at Yale and I was challenging them, and they said that their education is identical to medical students, except they also learn nutrition. That was her summary. It's like, well, wrong and wrong.
Wow.
It's wrong that it's the same as medical school and, we get nutritional training. You know, it's not like, it was ridiculous. So they create these charts. So in her first two posts are going to go over naturopathic education. Say, this is the education they're actually getting. Forget the propaganda that they're putting out there. They're trying to claim that they get like equivalent hours to medical students in the various categories. But in each category, what they don't tell you is that they're just lumping in all of the pseudoscientific nonsense. You know, like they're counting homeopathy hours in pharmacology and, you know what I mean?
Oh my gosh.
So it doesn't matter that they're also getting some basic science training, because it's all in the context of a philosophy of medicine that has no standard of care and is not based upon science. In practice, what naturopathy is an eclectic collection of pretty much anything that's unscientific. Homeopathy, acupuncture, their own form of water therapy or hydrotherapy, energy.
Applied kinesiology is another one.
Applied kinesiology, mm-hmm. Iridology, you know, energy medicine.
Yeah. Oh, iridology. That's huge. Yeah. That's huge. At the Mind Body Wallet fairs here in Sydney and mm-hmm. around Australia, when you go to that, there are always iridologists there. It's huge.
And they prescribe supplements like there's no tomorrow. I got the worst example. I had a patient who was misdiagnosed by a naturopath and was, dying of a neurological disease. And the naturopath, first of all, eliminated just about everything from his diet. They do a lot of diet elimination therapy because they, you know, diagnose food allergies a lot, and had replaced them with about 60 different supplements. It was ridiculous. And the guy was all emaciated, you know, cachectic by the time he got to the real hospital. Yeah. So I recommend that you understand what naturopathy really is. It is a philosophy-based system of medicine. Not to knock philosophers, it's just that's what you call it when you're not based on science, but there's just a belief. There's a belief system, and you treat according to belief system.
Yeah.
And Hermes explains that really well, how, like, in their clinics, a patient would come in, and they would go through their differential diagnosis, and it would include some of the usual stuff, like, oh, you have stomach pains, well, it could be this or that real thing, or it could be gluten sensitivity or candida hypersensitivity. And then they would prescribe a whole bunch of stuff, including, you know, some energy realignment and some hydrotherapy and, you know, a whole bunch of
aromatherapy
of supplements and whatever. So it's just completely mixing in the pseudoscience from top to bottom. And she said, again, in her experience, you really couldn't predict what one naturopath was going to do versus another. There's essentially no standard. There's no established standard of care. There's no basis upon which to say one thing is right and another thing is wrong.
But they have a common enemy, which is the orthodox medicine. Allopathy.
Yeah, well, yeah. Anyone using the term allopathy is a pseudoscientist, basically. So in any case, I recommend reading those on science-based medicine. It is, I think, one of the things that we need to increase public awareness about, because in the United States, Richard, they are tirelessly pushing state by state for licensure. And then once they get licensure, they want more and more privileges. They want to be able to prescribe medicines. They want to be able to function, get referrals from insurance companies for a primary care physician. And they're just not qualified. They do not have the training to function as primary care doctors, but they want to function that way, many of them. And that is very, very dangerous.
Do they get insurance? Are they part of, tied into the insurance system?
Well, it's all state by state. So yes, some states do require it. So, because again, if there are vested interests that will tirelessly lobby for their interest, and you know, who's to stand up against them? It's just, you know, a very small group of skeptics fighting on 1,000 fronts. So we are working on it. We are trying to keep careful tabs on any naturopathic bills that come up in any state and make sure that somebody who knows what they're talking about gets the right information to the legislators. That is one legislative battle that we are fighting. But it's every year, you know, every legislative session, there's three or four states or more where we have to keep them at bay. It's tireless. All right, let's go on. There's going to be no Who's That Noisy this week because Jay's not here and nobody had an opportunity to replace it. So Jay will be back next week with the follow-up of Who's That Noisy. I do want to do one quick email. We haven't done email in a while because all of our other segments are kind of crowding it out. So this one comes from Steve from Canada. Steve writes, "Hi all." He says, "I'll make it brief. I'm a lazy sod, but with a good environmentally friendly heart, metaphorically speaking. I have been considering installing a garbage disposal in my sink as part of our kitchen remos. My wife thinks composting all our waste is better for the environment, but it is messy, smelly, and inconvenient, especially with meat and fish waste, which gets a bit funky in the summer. I find conflicting information when I do a bit of research. What's the friggin' deal?" Well, Steve from Canada. Yeah, I mean, you pretty much got it. I mean, I'm familiar with composting. I haven't taken the bullet myself. I haven't started. I've been thinking about composting for my garden. Just haven't had the time to, the activation energy to get it going. But, I know people who compost, you know, and I've read a lot about it, and I did some more research, to help answer this question. So the essence of composting is that you take any organic waste, basically your food items, anything that's biodegradable, but could also be like eggshells and banana peels and leftover food, basically. And instead of throwing that away, you put it in a big bin. But you have to put it there with other things, for example, like bacterial cultures.
Right. It has to be able to break
yeah.
down.
And you can also put it in there like with grass clippings or other things too. And then it has to get warm, you know, so it heats up. The degradation of the organic material gets it warm and the bacteria chews it up. And over time, it breaks it down into a nice compost, into a nice fertilizer. It's just really thick organic material. So it's great. The end result is great if you have a use for, you know, the fertilizer. And it does remove, waste from
landfills.
Yeah, from landfills and from the garbage stream. So it's a perfectly good thing to do. However, it's not easy. It's not something that you should take on lightly. It does require maintenance. You know, it's not a do it and forget it kind of project. You're going to have to dedicate a certain amount of time to maintaining
your
compost.
Owning a pet, maybe.
Yeah, that's probably not a, not a, depending on the pet, you know, that's probably not a bad analogy.
Dog or cat. Yeah.
So it's also, you gotta have a place to put it. You know, I can't imagine doing it unless you have an outdoor bin, you know, cause it can get a bit smelly.
The only people I know who compost are hardcore gardeners, at least, you know, of the individuals that I've ever met. I've never met someone who's kind of gone, as you described, halfway with it, Steve, or you know, their heart not entirely in it. They've got some marvelous, you know, landscaping that they've done or have gardens that they maintain. Those are the ones that go through and put the time and effort into to make composting work for them. But that's the only time I've really ever seen it in action.
Yeah. And if you live in a northern environment, or southern, Richard, on your, in your hemisphere. If you live in a cold environment where it gets, we have a winter where it gets sub-freezing, you have to maintain it during the winter as well. One of my big concerns is, am I going to have to trudge out in the snow to my compost bin in the middle of the winter to
nope,
get rid of my...
That's why you have kids. Yeah, you send them to do it.
Well, yeah. But,
get your shovel and turn that compost pile.
So I think
shut the door on the way out.
If there are composters out there that want to tell us their personal experience, or add to this, go ahead. But I think the bottom line is, yeah, it's overall a good thing, but it's no small investment of time and effort. So if you're considering doing it, read up on it, see what it really involves, make sure it's right for you. All right. Evan, you sent me the dumbest thing I heard this week. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, dumbest thing. So I read an article from metro.co.uk, and the headline was, "Does this week's solar eclipse prove the moon is a giant alien spaceship?" And I'm like, okay, so we've got two sort of different things going on here, but they do kind of bring it all together. There is, or actually by the time you're listening to this, there just was a solar eclipse, primarily in the western part of Europe is where it will be most visible. You know, it's also a super moon. It's also the first day of spring. So there's sort of all these things coinciding together, which is kind of cool in its own right.
Yeah, however, have a snowstorm coming for our first day of spring. Thank you.
Yay. Yay. Thank you, global shifting global patterns. Wonderful.
Climate change, Evan. It's climate change.
It's nice here in the subarctic. I love it here. Okay, but there are some folks out there who are quite convinced that the moon is not a natural satellite, but actually an artificial space station. Now, we're not talking about, you know, Ben Kenobi and Han Solo here. We're talking, you know, real people. Who's the fella here? Christopher Knight, in a recent YouTube video. He's the author of something called Who Built the Moon? He says that the same numbers keep popping up. As Isaac Asimov said, the eclipse is the most extraordinary coincidence. We started to look at the numbers, he and his crack team, I guess, and they all worked perfectly. For example, the Earth rotates 366 times as it goes around the Sun once. So you could say that the Earth's number is 366.
Could say that.
And the Earth, you could say
arbitrarily the choose the sidereal number of days instead of.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And, but Steve, but here's the key. The Earth is 366% times the size of the moon. And that's, that struck Christopher Knight and his crack research staff as crazy because the number 366 kept popping up.
Yeah. That's numerology. Yes. You know, so they don't realize how many.
If you look for something, you're about to find it.
And they don't realize how many different things they're choosing from. Like, as I was alluding to, why pick the sidereal year versus the regular year? Like, you could easily use 365 instead of 366 or whatever. There's wiggle room everywhere, you know, in terms of what numbers you're using.
Yeah.
The eclipse is not that big a coincidence when you consider the fact that, you know, everything sort of orbits in the same plane. And although a little bit, you know, it's not all perfectly lined up, but every now and then, you know, things crisscross. It makes sense. Not that huge a cosmic coincidence. The thing that's a bit of a cosmic coincidence is that the apparent size of the sun and the apparent size of the moon overlap. Historically.
In time.
Yeah.
A billion
years ago they didn't, but the apparent size of both increases and decreases depending on our distance from them. But, and those variabilities do overlap. So that is a bit of a cosmic coincidence. But again, not so much so that we have to hypothesize, you know, something supernatural, right?
And okay, but let's say their weird numerology is right. They jump to the conclusion that therefore the moon is somehow artificial and there are creatures or some other intelligence controlling it. Where's that coming from? It's such a leap. It's just ridiculous.
It could be that they're just true believers, that the UFO belief comes first and they're just looking for weird stuff to justify it. But I do think that some people, like those coincidences, when things line up like that, that just jacks right into some part of their brain where they're like, that can't be a coincidence. The universe is
not natural.
It's telling us something. They just can't reality check it. You know, to them, it's absolutely a real thing.
So dumbest thing of the week.
The moon is the spaceship.
The moon's a spaceship.
That's pretty dumb.
And when you're watching the solar eclipse, it's being controlled by aliens. So there you have
it. There you go. All right. Thanks, Evan. Yep. Well, guys, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yeah.
As ready as I was last week.
Yeah. This is your first one this year, Richard.
Oh, I can't remember what my track record is, but it's probably very good, but we'll see.
Okay. All right. You're very confident. Here we go. Item number one. A new analysis finds that beetles as a group have an extremely low extinction rate, which is partially responsible for their extensive diversity. Item number two. Flies have a stunted pair of hind wings that rapidly vibrate and act as gyroscopes, detecting pitch, yaw, and roll in flight. And item number three. A new study finds that people generally become more distrusting and suspicious as they become older. Richard, since you're very confident, I'll let you go first.
Well, let me have a look at these now. A new analysis finds that beetles as a group have an extremely low extinction rate. You know, I've got a very good friend by the name of Dr. Paul Willis, who leads the Royal Institution of Australia in the city of Adelaide. And one of the points he continually makes is that there are more beetles around than just about anything else. He thinks that God must have favored beetles at some stage or other.
Well, so that's the John B. Haldane quote, right?
Inordinately fond of beetles.
Yes, that's right.
And why not?
So, number one is appealing on that premise, but number two is appealing too because it sort of makes sense. Flies are remarkable flyers. They really are. They're tremendous at flying upside down and around corners, and they can change direction very quickly. So I'm also tempted by number two. And number three is sort of self-evident. Or maybe I'm just misinterpreting people around me. Am I getting older? Am I getting more suspicious as I get older? Maybe so. This is a tough one. A new study finds that people generally become more. You know what? Because of the amazing ability of your average fly. They've been studied for many years. Look, I'm going to have a pot shot. I'm going to say number two is the science. The flies.
Yeah, so one of these is fiction, so two of them are science and one
I'm
is
working
fiction.
On it.
Yeah. Just want to remind you. I haven't played a while.
I do know that. I did, but I can't decide now between one and two is the other science one. I think three, a new study finds, I don't know, I don't like the sound of that. I'm going to go with the Beatles too. I think that's the science. So by process of elimination, I'm going to pot number three as the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, the beetle one. Yeah, we've all heard of it. There's lots of them. This would be an interesting reason why they're so prevalent, why there's so much diversity, but it could simply just totally be baloney too, of course. I have no way to really figure out which one it is. So I'll have to use the other ones to help me decide. Older and more suspicious. Yeah, that seems obvious too. And I think we've covered something almost identical to this at some point. I think in an older science or fiction. But the one that I'm really kind of skeptical of is the B one. And that's because
the fly one.
Flies
are not bees.
I'm aware of that. But are you aware that it's probably bullshit that, what, the stunted wings that we've never seen before. They must be really stunted if we've never seen them before. And the other problem is that a simple vibration, I don't think, is going to act as an effective gyroscope. You're going to need some sort of rotation to really be a good gyroscope. So based on that, I think that's total crap. I'm going to say that's fiction.
Okay, Evan?
You know, beetles as a group have an extremely low extinction rate. I disagree with that. Two of them are gone. Ringo and Paul are still hanging around. But, you know, I really wouldn't say that it's a low extinction
Beetlejuice,
rate.
Beetlejuice.
What? Oh, wait. Oh, I should have read it, not just listened to it. Okay, never mind.
Yeah, really funny you are.
I'm one of the Beatles.
Yeah, you're really funny. I like that. Yeah.
What's this thing called, love?
Look out for the cappy drawing with Queen Victoria.
Unlike you guys, I know that I shouldn't even try.
Why not? Bob, come on.
Neither should we.
It's like getting naked in a hot tub. Everyone's doing it. Well, in any case. Okay. The second one about flies having a stunted pair of hind wings that rapidly vibrate, acting as gyroscopes. I think, Bob, what you said there actually, you know, made a lot of sense. It's not something I thought about. It's like, really, is that a gyroscope sort of mechanism through vibration of the wings? It seems extreme. The last one about people generally becoming more distrusting and suspicious, that hasn't been proven before. So this is new information. The gyroscopes thing, like Bob said, is really getting me. So I'm going to have to go with Bob on this one and say it's flies. Sorry, Richard. Don't mean to leave you alone, but that's what it has to be.
All right.
So Bob and Evan think that the fly gyroscopes are fiction. Richard, you think that the people getting more distrusting as they get older is a fiction. So you all agree. A new analysis finds that beetles as a group have an extremely low extinction rate, which is partially responsible for their extensive diversity. You all think that is science, and that one is science.
Yay!
Good job. So, yeah, this is very interesting. The study was looking at families within the group beetles, and they found an extremely low extinction rate. So the scientist, so the lead author on this was Dina Smith, curator of the Invertebrate Paleontology and associate professor of geologic science at the University of Colorado Museum of Natural History. And she says, people don't think of insects as having an extensive fossil record, but they really do. And we've been able to, you know, we talk about like the evolution of dinosaurs into birds and things like that, but there's actually really good documentation of even major changes within insect evolution. The insect order Coleoptera is beetles, and there are many families in that order. In fact, so you know what she found is that one particular subgroup, the Polyphaga, had no family level extinctions.
Oh, nice.
Every known family within the group Polyphaga are still extant.
Wow.
She thinks because that beetles are so successful because they tend to have a very varied diet. They can eat a lot of different stuff.
Right. Of course. Particularly
the group Polyphaga, which means...
Makes sense. I can eat anything.
Eats a lot of different things. Yeah. So it's not clear, although the evidence suggests that this would contribute to the fact that beetles are such a diverse group. Again, there are something like 70,000 or more known species of beetle. That this would certainly contribute to that. They hang around longer over time, over geological time. And so they have the opportunity to become extremely diverse. But, obviously would require more data to know and more different kinds of studies to know to what extent increased speciation plays a role in their diversity, right? Do they generate lots of species more quickly, or is it just that the species they create hang around longer?
Combination.
Yeah, right.
Or some combination. Yeah, so that, we can't say that we've nailed that down, but it certainly makes sense that a lower extinction rate would contribute to greater diversity. She also says that, we really don't have this same kind of analysis looking at extinction rates over time using the fossil record in an insect, within an insect order. Said that this really hasn't been done for other insect orders and that she says it should be because who knows? Maybe beetles are in fact not unique in this way. We don't know because we can't really compare to other insect orders. Maybe it's something that's common among insects. So anyway, I thought that was very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Beatles are, yeah, very interesting group. They're survivors. Beatles are survivors. All right. Let's go on to number two. Flies have a stunted pair of hind wings that rapidly vibrate and act as gyroscopes, detecting pitch, yaw, and roll in flight. Bob and Evan think this is the fiction. Richard, you think this one is science. And this one is...
Say it.
Science.
Ah! Wow.
Richard, good job. Good job, my friend.
Well done.
You beat out the two rogues.
Damn. Well, Bob, you know when you said, how can flies have these tiny little wings that we weren't aware of before? Well, it doesn't say that. I guess we've always been aware, or science has been aware of these little stunted parts of the fly, but it's only recently come to light what they do.
I didn't say this was a new news item in the text. You just assumed that.
Yes,
there is a new news item related to this, but it was just this fact alone, which is just a background to the study, I found more fascinating. So I just made it simple and went with this. In any case, yeah, so flies have a second pair of wings attached to the mesothorax, which is the second thoracic segment, the hind wings. And these hind wings in the flies have been modified to so-called halteres, H-A-L-T-E-R-E-S, which is like a stunted wing with a knob at the end. So it looks like a club, but it's very heavy. And that weight is important, of course. And they, you know, vibrate very quickly like wings do. And because they're so heavy, that vibration actually acts as a gyroscope.
Huh.
So when the flies, when they pitch, roll, or yaw, there are neurons at the base of these wings, these modified wings, that enable them to detect, because it will put torque, you know, on. That's how a gyroscope works. If it's moving very quickly, and if you move in one direction, it kind of torques the gyroscope, and the neurons can sense that, and then the fly knows which way it's moving, and that information can be incorporated into its flying. So that's why, as Richard observed, flies are extremely maneuverable flyers.
Well, they are in this country anyway.
Yeah. And this is the explanation for that. They are such precise flyers because they have these built-in gyroscopes, which is awesome. The new study, which is a little bit more speculative, finds that it was a study of wings in insects in general. And what they found was that wings will twist and flex like gyroscopes in response to pitch, yaw, and roll. So they hypothesized that in some insects, their wings may be able to function as gyroscopes the same way these hind wings do in flies. But that is still speculation. They would have to do further study to find if they have the neural connections and do they actually function that way. It's just physically possible for them to function that way because they do sort of twist and morph in response to the movement of the insect.
Wow.
So a gyroscope doesn't automatically imply that there's some sort of rotation.
Right. It's just, it's moving. I mean, it may be making little circles. I don't know. The descriptions just said vibrate. And so I'm assuming they move very similar to wings, vibrating back and forth. And I guess that's enough, but maybe they do make little circles. I don't know. But yeah, that doesn't have to be spinning like a typical mechanical gyroscope would. Okay. All of this means that a new study finds that people generally become distrusting and suspicious, more distrusting and suspicious as they become older is fiction, as Richard successfully determined. In fact, the new study shows
just
the opposite. As people get older, they get more trusting.
Really?
And more trusting and more kind.
I don't believe that. I'm sorry. I just.
So basically their defense mechanisms break down with age. That's what you're saying.
Well, that's a good question, Evan. So the article, the researchers talk about the fact that, old people can be very susceptible to con artists and scams.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is that because they're becoming more trusting? But they said, you know, based upon their data, not necessarily. They said it could have to do with the fact that as people get older, they get increasingly motivated to give back to others, as one of the researchers said. One thing that helps motivate giving behavior is the belief that others are good and worthwhile. So that those two things go hand in hand. Yeah. So people get are happier as they get older. This, that many studies show that we basically get happier as we get older, more content. You know, not as bothered as much by little things because, you know, we realize they don't, you know, don't sweat the little things, you know, right? As you get older, you sort of understand that more. Whereas younger people may get very upset about things that older people realize don't freaking matter, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, so anyway, obviously this is one slice of data. It's not, it was just a survey, you know, so it's not, it can't really simultaneously address all of these questions. There's actually a series of studies they published that are in the process of being published as one paper. But yeah, it's I think actually consistent with other, you know, previously published research showing the trends of sort of psychological outlook of people as we get older, which is kind of nice to know that as we get older, we get less anxious, we get more trusting, more kind, less worried about things, you know, kind of eases the way.
Yes.
I think it's partly just wisdom. I do think it's just part of wisdom. You get more life experiences.
Yeah,
that's
a good point.
You know, you learn more about what's important in life and what the stuff that's not worth worrying about, you know.
I mean, you still have the occasional curmudgeon who hurls his cane at you and tells you to get off his lawn and stuff.
Yeah, I know. That's sort of the cliche, but they were probably curmudgeons when they were younger, right?
I mean, I don't know if there's been a study done on that exactly, but you might be right.
They just didn't have canes and lawns when they were younger. So
yeah.
Get off
they
my
couldn't
lawn,
express
kid
themselves
study.
Properly. Yeah, right. That would be a good one.
Richard, good job.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, soul hey. Victor.
Wow.
I don't know. I'm doing a quick Google on gyroscopes, and it seems like spinning is pretty integral. I think they just used a bad analogy.
It's not an analogy, Bob. It's not an analogy. They are functionally gyroscopes because all that's required is that they're moving fast, and because of that, when you rotate them in three dimension, it creates a tangential force that can then be detected, so that information can go to the fly's nervous system and it can adjust its flying. It is functionally a gyroscope. Just because they doesn't work exactly the way as mechanical gyroscopes doesn't mean it's not a gyroscope.
Says you.
Yeah.
Bob, don't try though.
I don't turn into a mechanical engineer
on us.
You planned it all along, didn't you? Bob's gonna think this, so he's gonna go for that. So
every week, I'm primarily just trying to.
Yeah, like last
Bob.
Week yes. when he pitched you that softball about the freaking numbers of stars in the Andromeda Galaxy, which you've known since you were two.
Bob, why don't you
it
just
was
do
a little
what,
bit more complicated than that?
Bob, just do what I do. Just send Steve $10 the week before. It's easy.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
I highly recommend that method.
I've been sending him $9. That's why it's not working.
All right. Yeah, Richard outbid you. Sorry about that. All right, Evan,
good job,
give us
Richard.
A quote.
All right, here is this week's quote. The man of science has learned to believe in justification, not by faith, but by verification. A quote from Thomas Henry Huxley, T.H., to his friends, T.H. Huxley.
T.H. Huxley, Bob, would you consider him a forgotten superhero of science? He's not really that forgotten, but I don't know how many people really know about him. He's not as famous as he should be, maybe. I mean, he was just such a...
Yeah.
He's close to my heart because he was a powerful intellectual that communicated science to the public. So he was Darwin's bulldog. He didn't come up with evolution, but it was his job to convince the rest of the world that Darwin was right. And you got to give that respect, you know?
Yeah, sometimes I think we're biased a bit on who is forgotten and not, because to me it's obvious that he is not forgotten. But you're right. I'm sure there's a lot of people that aren't familiar with him. But I mean, if you have to tie any one person to Darwin, I mean, he's in the top two or three. I mean, if you know Darwin, you've probably heard of him as well. So maybe
on, Bob. Everybody knows Darwin. I think very few people, percentage-wise, know who T.H. Huxley was. If you go up on the street to somebody, they'll know who Charles Darwin was.
Well, of course.
Yeah, but if you say who was T.H. Huxley, they'll have no idea.
No, they probably.
No, you're right. But some people would have heard Darwin's bulldog. That's around. But yeah, a lot of people.
Right. Yeah, that's around.
Yeah. That's what I mean. It's maybe semi-forgotten, but I wouldn't even think of covering him. But we'll see.
He coined the term agnostic.
Yeah.
Defined agnosticism as a method, the essence of which lies in the rigorous application of a single principle, the axiom that every man should be able to give a reason for the faith that is in him. And did you know T.H. Huxley regarded the Bible highly, both as one of the great works of English literature and as a defense of freedom and liberty? So he was not, you know, all coming down fire and brimstone, shall, if I can borrow the phrase,
so to speak,
against the people who had faith. He, you know, actually showed some appreciation for the fiction itself, the Bible. Mm-hmm. So, there you go. Something you didn't know.
So Nexus registration is still open. And by the time you're hearing this, there's only a couple of days left to get early bird registration for Nexus up until March 23rd. And then prices will go up a little bit. So if you want to get your early bird registration, do it now. Don't forget about the Friday Night Extravaganza. Richard, you had an opportunity to see the SGU Skeptical Extravaganza while we were in Sydney.
I did. That was extravagant. It was great fun.
Tell everybody how awesome it was.
It was one of the highlights. It was one of the highlights of the national convention last year, where of course SGU were front and center. It was a packed room, as I seem to remember. Lots of laughs. It was really a good event, and you even sang "Happy Birthday" to me, which I found pretty wonderful.
And this time we're going to have Bill Nye, so it's going to be even better.
Ooh,
can you imagine? Oh boy. So anyway, you could register for the extravaganza, register for the Nexus conference. Just go to necss.org. What else we got going on? I think there's still time to vote for you. I probably also until March 23rd for the podcast awards. So go to podcastawards.com. Vote for your favorite podcast there. The SGU is nominated in the science category. And registration will be opening soon for TAM 13. We'll give you some more information about that next week.
Oh, and don't forget, people in Australia and all around the world can hear me and our wonderful bunch of reporters on the Skeptic Zone podcast, www.skepticzone.tv, featuring Maynard and Joe Alabaster, Ron Sagiv, Heidi Robinson, Dr. Aichi. It's lots of fun.
All right. Good talking to you all again this week, as always.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Richard.
Richard, it's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Richard.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Evan. Thank you, John Boy.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.